You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Anger is all around us. It's part of who we are, how we interact, and it has its place and purpose. But we aren't always great at processing and communicating our anger. And we often really need help when we're on the receiving end of someone who's angry and treating us badly as a result. Those negative, potentially explosive interactions can be one-offs with someone you'll never see again, or they could be repeated with someone who's got a consistent presence in your professional, personal, or family life. Our next guest has advice for handling these situations, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. When and how do you interact with angry people? How do you handle it? If you work at a job where the customers or clients are sometimes mad at you, how do you react to that? Have you had a long-term family situation with anger that you found some way to resolve? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Martin is professor of psychology at UW Green Bay and author of the book Why We Get Mad. His new book is called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Now, we talked about your last book, Why We Get Mad, and that was meant as an aid for dealing with our own anger. This is for dealing with the anger of others. What led you to write this book?
Yeah, it actually started with a request from a friend who said she was dealing with other people's anger and was wondering if I could write. It started as a blog post a long time ago for Psychology Today. Said, would you take some time and give me some strategies? And then about 2 years ago, I turned that same blog post into a TikTok series, and it got a lot of interest, and a lot of people reached out and told me that they needed this kind of help. And so it felt like a good approach for my next book.
Before we get into strategies for dealing with angry people, you make an important distinction right up front between, you know, someone who's angry and something that might be a chronically abusive relationship where someone might use displays of anger as an instrument of control. This is a different situation than the anger we're mostly going to talk about here, right?
Yeah, I really want to make clear right out of the gate that this book is not for people who are in an abusive relationship. It's not for people who are being harmed by someone, either physically or emotionally. That's not what this book is for. It's for people who experience either through their job or because of someone they know, they live with or experience someone else who is angry. And it's important to note, too, that sometimes the angry people we deal with day in and day out aren't necessarily angry with us, right? They might be angry at the world. They might be angry often, and you're present for that anger, but it isn't necessarily directed at you in a way that is harmful or hostile.
Now, let's talk a little bit about anger as an emotional state. I'm angry in the moment. Compared with anger as a personality trait, that so-and-so is an angry person.
Yeah, like any emotion, anger is something that everybody feels. We feel it a couple of times a week to a couple of times a day. But at the same time, there are these individual differences with regard to how often or how intensely we experience anger. And some people are angrier than others. And for those people who are angrier than others, who tend to get angry more often, who get angrier than people typically do, or even who express that anger in really maladaptive ways, we tend to think of them as having, being what we call high on trait anger, meaning that they have more of an angry personality trait. And so there are people out there who, may know a person who's high in trait anger, and then this book is a good fit for them and offers some strategies there. There are also people, though, who, because of the type of job they have, usually service providers, who will tell you that they just work with, they encounter a lot of people who are high in state anger, because of the nature of the job.
Now, with different types of communication with angry people, you have a lot of suggestions that might work for any kinds of those interactions. The first one's really interesting. When we're dealing with someone who's angry, either in the moment or chronically, the notion that we want to work out what we really want out of this. How can we do that? How can we figure out, what do I want to come from my interactions with this angry person? It sounds easier said than done in some ways.
Yeah, I think it often is. And that's why it's important to sort of step back and focus on that. When you're in an interaction with an angry person, you may find yourself wanting to do some things that aren't actually best for you or best for that interaction. And so what I encourage people to do is to think about their goals and think about their desired outcome. And what I mean is there are times where maybe you're confronted by someone, maybe someone is angry with you, and what you decide you want to do is get back at them in some way or lash out back at them. And when we're in this kind of emotional situation, we bring our own emotions to the table as well. And so when someone's angry at me, I might respond with my own anger. I might respond with some sadness. I might respond with some fear or guilt or something else. And so in that moment, sometimes we lose sight of what is best for us. And this first strategy is really about saying, okay, what is best for me? What is best to get out of this situation in a healthy, positive way? And it might be different than sort of what my instincts are telling me in the moment.
Talking to Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay, author of the new book, How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice, maybe your strategies for dealing with difficult people, say on the job, if you encounter a lot of anger in your line of work. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in Madison. Pat, hi.
Hi there. So I stayed angry for a long time in my life. I grew up with two alcoholic parents and, you know, very dysfunctional. And I learned that anger was a big cover-up for me for the sadness that I was dealing with. And I used to have these fits of rage. You know, they called me this angry person. And you know, I think the best strategy for me was to have friends and everybody just say, you know, what's really going on? You know, instead of saying, calm down, you know, if they just said, hey, you know, what's going on? And, you know, what I learned through going to Al-Anon to deal with the alcoholic parents, I found out that, you know, it was really just this big cover-up. And I just needed people around me to just get me to calm down, you know.
Pat, thank you so much for sharing that story. And, Ryan, that takes me right toward one of your steps that Pat's friends, it sounds like they understood this, understand anger from the other person's perspective. Could you talk about that, Ryan, and how it fits into Pat's story?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think one thing I'd note about that story is that there are a lot of people out there who point to anger as a quote unquote secondary emotion, meaning it stems from other feeling states like sadness or hurt or things like that. And that is absolutely true some of the time. And it certainly sounds like it was true this time. Sometimes anger can be a primary emotion, and sometimes it can really stem from other things. In fact, there was recent research that just came out that really found a link between those aversive childhood experiences, like he was describing, and adulthood anger, saying the more traumatic the childhood, essentially, the more likely you were to be experience anger in adulthood. Now, I think that one of the things that I think is really important is for people to be able to do what I call diagramming an angry incident from another person's perspective. And what I really mean there is think about what is causing that anger, but try to think about it in a really holistic way. So bring into it, you know, the ways in which they might be interpreting some of these, what's happening to them, some of the when you know those childhood experiences, when you can think about how emotions were modeled for the person, which sometimes we can't do, but sometimes we can. Thinking about even the mood state they're in at the time of the provocation. Are they under a lot of stress? Are they exhausted? And so on. All of those, they do two things for us. One, It's about empathy. It's about learning to kind of see things from the other person's perspective, develop a little bit of understanding as to what they're dealing with and what they're going through. But it also might tell you where to intervene. And it might give you a sense for, okay, so now that I understand the cause fully and completely, instead of, as the caller mentioned, instead of just telling the person to relax, I can potentially, again, depending on my relationship with the person, mm-hmm. dig into some of those causes. I can say, hey, what's really going on? And we can unpack some of that.
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to UW-Green Bay professor of psychology, Ryan Martin, about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to deal with angry people? Do you have an anecdote, a story to share about a time when you or someone you interacted with was the angry party, how the situation played out, escalated, or was resolved in a better way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW-Green Bay, and we're talking about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. You can join in with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Heartland. Beth, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Beth?
So one thing that I'm noticing, I am in a public education, and the thing that I see is that when I'm angry with somebody for, like, the experience today was somebody not holding up the end of their job, not doing their job, actually. And what I found was that I could be angry at the person who didn't follow through, and yet I needed to separate my feelings toward the person who didn't do their job and yet be really action-oriented toward putting the student first and, like, making sure that the student is focused on first and taking an action step to make sure the student's needs are met versus being angry at the person for not doing their job.
Okay, Beth, I got to ask, this sounds great. Is that easy for you to do? Because I think I would have a hard time, you know, staying that calm and taking my feelings out of it.
Well, and I think that it's important for us to take a little space and mentally say, okay, first we're going to deal with, like, for our situation today, that there wasn't a process in place for this to happen. And so I can say, like, let's think about a process first so that it doesn't happen again. Because I have to take my feelings out of it, but there's a little voice inside my head that says, this is not about you, Beth. This is about making sure that we have a process so this doesn't happen again.
Fantastic.
And I feel like people are able to take that because then they don't get attacked, right? And we put the kids first.
Beth, thanks so much for sharing that. Ryan, sounds like Beth is a pro. And again, she's talking, I think, right out of your book here.
Yeah, I mean, there is an art and a skill to being able to stay calm in those situations and ultimately redirect that and channel that for anger or whatever emotion you're feeling into something sort of positive and pro-social. I'm a big advocate for trying to solve problems when you are feeling anything. I mean, I think at a very, very basic level, one of the things our emotions are telling us is that we've got some sort of problem. And so a way of dealing with that is to try and solve whatever that problem is. Of course, finding ways to stay calm and keep your cool is it's one of the things I talk about in the book, and it is a real it's a real art that takes a lot of practice and time.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's dig into that, Ryan. Somebody's mad at us. They're yelling at us. The last thing I probably feel then is calm and collected. How do I get there?
Yeah. So this is such a challenge, and I can't say that there's a simple way to do it. A couple things I advocate. One is to actually take some time to reflect back on experiences after the fact, to do a little bit of practicing in your head. I liken it to how athletes oftentimes watch game tape. You know, if you think through this interaction and maybe ask yourself, where could I have done things differently? Or where could I have handled this situation a little differently? not in a way that is self-critical, which I think people often do, but in a way that is really reflective and preparing for future experiences. One of our goals has to be to find that moment to pause and to kind of hit that pause button and learn to relax in the moment. That comes through practice. That comes through sort of intentional activity and reflection.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I guess I got two parts to it. One is my experience in my adult life is with men. Anger very often manifests with aggression and threats, physical threats. And the other part that I've heard about is that at least for older men, I guess senior, older than 60, men that can suffer from depression, that the depression can manifest as anger.
Interesting, Tom. Thanks for those questions. Let's start with the first one. When anger ends up intentionally or unintentionally being a threatening, aggressive display, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it is undeniable that men are more likely to express their anger outwardly than women are. Not necessarily through aggression, but sometimes through aggression. So outward expressions of anger can include also just yelling and swearing and screaming and things like that, but not necessarily with the intent to harm. When there is that intent to harm, one of the things I talk about is you really need to disengage in those moments and prioritize safety above and beyond all else. As for the piece about depression, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting, and I suspect in many ways the caller is right, and I also think that there's probably some generational differences that might be present there, in the sense that, you know, oftentimes men have been taught historically not to express particular feelings like sadness or fear. And so I do think there is a tendency for some of those feelings to come out in other ways. And I think that's particularly true of older generations that have where that there wasn't really as much modeling of some of those other emotional expressions.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Ryan Martin about his book, How to Deal with Angry People. Ryan, I want to conjure up a scenario here. We had an airline fiasco not that long ago where gate attendants were dealing with lots and lots of angry people who couldn't get where they were going. The gate attendants had really nothing to offer them, thanks to their company, to help them out with it. In that situation, somebody's angry at you because of something that's not your fault and you really have nothing to solve their problem with. How could you deal with that kind of anger with your customers?
Yeah, I think a lot of times dealing with that sort of frustration is, I mean, obviously when we can solve their problem, we should, especially if we're the ones who are in part responsible for it. But I think that sometimes what people actually really want is to feel heard. And so taking moments to listen, feel that sort of, to sort of empathize with them and to do what we can is really, really important. Again, it doesn't mean tolerating abuse. It doesn't mean tolerating a real intense hostility, but it means sort of hearing and giving them that space to share that frustration.
And then a much more personal setting, and you write a lot about this in the book, where someone might have a family member and they feel that family member, they like them for the most part, love them probably, but anger, at least periodically, chronically, gets in the way. What are some strategies for dealing with that kind of long-term anger within your own family?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really tough, you hear a lot from people that online that I've talked to say, you know what, if I'm surrounded by someone who's angry, I just want to disengage and cut them loose and they're toxic and do away with them. And one of the things I found in talking to people is that isn't really, for many people, realistic, and it isn't necessarily what they want to do. They want to have a relationship with that person, And they feel compelled because that person is sort of entangled in their life in all sorts of ways through their siblings or through their kids or their other parents or whatever. And so they really want to have some sort of relationship with them or feel like they need to have that relationship with them. I think there is the possibility of sort of disengaging in some ways, meaning maybe you minimize contact or you keep contact in only in certain ways. You find ways to effectively communicate with them that might be different than some traditional ways. So maybe you text them more frequently instead of actually having a face-to-face conversation, things like that to try and engage. I also think there are times where, and plenty of people that I talked to advocated the just direct conversation, saying, you know, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm concerned about, and I think we need to sort of reframe how we interact moving forward.
And briefly, Ryan, I want to take this back to your first book now. How can we diagnose if we are the person who's putting other people in this situation in the first place? How do we diagnose our own problem anger, just briefly?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is doing your part to listen to what people are telling you. And so if people are giving you that information that your anger is distressing to them, I think you got to hear that and take it to heart, especially if they're people you're close to. I tend to focus on the consequences, though. Think about the way, there's nothing unhealthy about anger on its own, but think about the ways that your anger might be causing relationship distress, might be causing you some emotional distress, might be leading to other sorts of problems. Pay attention to that sort of thing, and it'll give you a pretty good clue.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. We talked to him about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now we travel with our taste buds to Poland. It's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're going to talk to the owner of Door County's only Polish restaurant. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Polish cuisine? Do you have Polish heritage, enthusiasm for Polish food? Did you grow up eating pierogi and other Polish foods? Do you make it yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Krzysztof Kroll is founder, owner, and head chef of Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim. Krzysztof, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Now, you're originally from Poland. I understand you're back visiting Poland right now. What brought you to Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I'm currently in Poland, came back for a three-week visit. What brought me to Wisconsin was a foreign exchange program from a university back home called Work and Travel. Door County hosts about 200 J-1 visa exchange students each summer, and I was one of them. And my first summer was in 2012.
What made you decide to end up staying in Door County and opening up a restaurant there?
Oh, believe me or not, but the first experience in America in Door County just made me realize that this is my second home now and that I want to continue my adventure here in America. A lot of cultural differences that I was met with when I first came. Notice how friendly and open-minded people are. How friendly Midwesterns are. I had the opportunity to go to a cultural exchange program to South Korea or Belgium later on, but that would have meant I couldn't have gone back to Door County for the summer, and I never wanted to miss out on it again. And since that first summer, I spent 11 consecutive summers in the U.S., having moved to Door County permanently in 2015.
You grew up.
And then, And then the story continues with me starting the restaurant. I just basically wanted to contribute to the community. And I dug in on the things that I could do best. And I have worked for numerous years in the restaurant industry. I have a passion for cooking and for entrepreneurship. And I've decided to fill in a gap in the market of a Polish cuisine in Wisconsin, since I've always believed we were underrepresented as a nation, despite the huge heritage, and decided to purchase an old building and turn it into a Polish restaurant.
Now, of course, you grew up with Polish food in Poland. Can you talk about how you learned about these foods from your mom, I understand, and your grandma?
Exactly. So first of all, the culture of eating out in Poland is not big at all. Me and my family of four, we possibly went out to eat once in my entire life growing up in Poland with my mom, my dad, and my sister. The reason for it is restaurants don't have the greatest reputation back home, since most of moms are housewives and they cook all of the homemade meals at home. And I've been around it all my life since my mom gave up her career. She has a master's degree in economics, and she dedicated herself to taking care of me and my sister and the house, which included making fresh home-cooked meals every day. So in order to spend more time with my mom, I would gladly join her in the kitchen so we can talk about school, life, wait till dad comes back from work, and then enjoy dinner together.
We're talking to Krzysztof Kroll. It's Food Friday. Krzysztof is head chef at Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. He's sharing Polish cuisine with us, some ingredients, some recipes coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite Polish food, if you grew up with it, if you have questions about making it, call 800-642-1234. Okay, Krzysztof, if I say Polish food to people, a lot of them, probably me too, will think pierogi. I grew up eating them. My Polish grandma cooked them all the time. What is the secret to making a great pierogi? Or pierog is singular. To make a great pierogi, plural.
Yeah, so the secret is, I'm going to have to say, you're not going to be great at it from the get-go. It takes a little bit of time and experience. It's a time-consuming process. Since you make the dough from scratch, you make the filling from scratch, and then you have to wrap it correctly, pinch it so it doesn't open up in a boiling water or a pan fry. So give yourself some credit for, you know, taking on this task. My secret would be the advice to people: divide the prep process into stages. Don't try to make the entire meal in 2 hours. It's going to be extremely difficult, and it's not really worth the time to make just one pierog or 10 pierogi. You need to make a few. And it's a very fun bonding activity that you could do with family members, friends, which is very common in Wisconsin from what I've been hearing from my patrons, is that they often gather together for Christmas Eve time or Easter just to make pierogies for the holiday season. And you just make a lot of them. So first, I would concentrate on the dough. Remember that flour makes things dry and water wet. So you just need a perfect combination of boiling water, salt, flour, preferably unbleached flour, and then a little bit of vegetable oil. And I practice this recipe just because it's vegan and I offer some vegan pierogies at my restaurant. So once you prepare the dough, then you have to create dough circles. You can use a glass to create dough circles that you wrap your filling into. And I recommend using parchment paper with flour so the dough circles do not stick to each other, so they can be used later on the next day. They could be up in the fridge up to 7 days. In the meantime, you'll make the filling fresh, and then you'll hand wrap them. You can use pinchers from Amazon or eBay, I highly recommend those. And yeah, you just need to focus on the double pinch when you're closing the pierogi, just so they don't open up in the water, because then you'll just get the dough and the filling will disintegrate.
I tried to make pierogies myself exactly once, and that's what I ended up with, floating dough and filling at the top of the pot. It was not a thing anybody was going to eat. Let's talk about fillings now. I grew up with the sauerkraut, like the cheese, the kind of cream cheese deal, like cheese, and then potato. Now, you have experimented with some other stuff for your Door County restaurant. What other things have you played with for your fillings?
Oh, so many things. This is one of my favorite things to do and talk about, is practice different pierogi recipes. There's so much different cuisine available here in the U.S. that I could learn from. And I went on some classic Wisconsin fillings, such as bacon mac and cheese, comfort food inside of Polish comfort food, pierogi. Kids love that special. I make Door County cherry and cream cheese pierogies, also for the local people in Door County. Potato cheddar jalapeno would be a little bit of a Hispanic fusion. Sauerkraut mushroom and kielbasa, the classic sauerkraut mushroom pierogi that you mentioned, mixed with our traditional Polish sausage. Some dessert pierogies covered with powdered sugar, chocolate or caramel drizzle, and whipped cream. The fillings would be banana and Nutella, a little chocolate banana pierogi, or wild blueberry. Even seasonal pierogies in the fall, like pumpkin spice, feature our menu. Spinach and feta is very light and fresh. Potato onion, another vegan pierogi. And also the classic cheese and potato, farmer's cheese, potato, and caramelized onion, or slow roasted pork. We've made them with beef and cheese before, but I've learned that the beef is a little bit too dry for a dumpling that you boil in water, if that makes sense.
I got to ask, Christoph, you're back in Poland. You tell people, yeah, I'm making pumpkin spice pierogi and bacon mac and cheeseburger. Are they like, that sounds great, Christoph, make it for us? Or are they like, what the heck are you doing to our pierogi?
That's a great question. Bacon mac and cheese. Mac and cheese is not a thing in Poland, really. I never grew up with it. I never grew up with ranch dressing or classic items on American tables. So I've never made those contemporary pierogies at home for, friends and family. They would be open to try it, although it just, like with your favorite foods, let's say a cheeseburger, it's good the way it is. You don't necessarily have to add too many things as a connoisseur. So I think for me, my personal favorite pierogi is cheese and potato. And every time I'm somewhere outside of Poland that has a Polish restaurant, I'm definitely going to try that flavor first, because this is our staple.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about Polish cooking with Christoph Kroll from the Prince of Pierogi restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have our guest about making Polish food at home? And I know we got some Polish heritage here in Wisconsin. Anybody have a story to share about foods you ate growing up, foods you make now, or maybe like me, have tried and failed to make over the years? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Christoph Kroll, founder, owner, and head chef at Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. It's Food Friday, and he's telling us about Polish cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about the foods, the ingredients, the recipes in Polish cuisine, maybe your own experiences, maybe growing up with it or encountering it in your travels, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn now, Christoph, to cabbage rolls, gwumkis, we called them. I don't know if we pronounced it right, the Polish growing up. Can you tell us about these Polish cabbage rolls?
Yes, you nailed it. It's pronounced gwumkis. At our restaurant, we have a nickname for them. We call them Polish burritos. It's basically a cabbage leaf peeled and wrapped around ground beef or pork, rice, tomato sauce, sautéed onions, sometimes mushrooms, parsley, salt, and pepper. Then you bake them for about an hour and a half. They come topped with a marinara sauce, but they don't have to, sour cream, and a little bit of dill on top. It's one of my favorite comfort foods. You could eat it with a knife and fork, or you don't. You can just use your hands. It's very popular in Poland. I would say it's our second most popular dish besides pierogies. It's really good and hearty on a cold day, but it also doesn't hurt to have one in the summer.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Evelyn is with us in Green Bay. Evelyn, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm enjoying the program. I'm familiar with his place as we go off to Door County quite often. But in the pierogi dough, do you put any egg in there?
So you say eggs in the dough, Evelyn? No, okay.
Yeah.
But you could. I have a recipe called Perfect. I have a book called Perfect Pierogi Dough Recipes, and there are a few recipes in there that include an egg-based dough. If you ever stop in at the restaurant, feel free to send me a message. I could pick up the book and share some of these recipes with you.
Thanks a lot, Evelyn, for calling in. Peter is with us now in Burlington. Peter, hi.
Hello. Just wanted to comment on the pierogi because I grew up in a Polish household where Christmas is not Christmas without pierogi. And I'm the youngest of eight, so we would make quite a few pierogi, as you can imagine. But we always made them with, we still make them with sauerkraut and onion mm-hmm. mixture. And just to Evelyn's comment about the egg, I found that if I just rub a little egg on the edge, I don't have them break open when I boil them too. So.
And Peter, did you eat them on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve? Because we did Christmas Eve with the pierogi.
Yeah, absolutely, Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve was our Christmas feast and celebration and the pierogi making process.
Same.
Would begin Christmas Eve. And hopefully there would be some leftovers for Christmas Day.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, and Christoph, our thing was we'd eat we'd have the Christmas Eve meal earlier in the day and we'd all hang out for some hours. And at some point, somebody sneaks back into the fridge and breaks out the leftovers and is round two on the pierogi. Can you talk about holiday traditions around some of these foods, Christoph?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's just the same in Poland. It's very, very big for Christmas. There's no Christmas without pierogi. One of the staples for a Polish Christmas is borscht, which is a beet soup that you eat with little dumplings. Every Polish dinner table for Christmas Eve has to have at least a variety of 13 different dishes. That's the tradition. You always have to have an extra setup for just in case a stranger or a traveler shows up at your door. So you're obligated to host him to your family's Christmas dinner. The most popular pierogi for Christmas is sauerkraut and mushroom pierogi. And it's a family gathering. It's probably the biggest. Poland is a Catholic country, 99% Catholic country. So it's a very big event in every Polish family.
Peter, thanks a lot for sharing your experience at 800-642-1234. Talking to Christoph Kroll with the Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County on this edition of Food Friday. Back to your calls now with Laura in Cudahy. Laura, hello.
Hi. In 2014, my husband and I had included Poland as part of our travels that summer, and we ate a lot of pierogi while we were there. And a couple weeks after we got back from vacation, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had an article about a family and their pierogi making, and they had a recipe for pierogi. And so I tried it. And as I make it more and more often, I get better and better at it. And it's probably now my favorite meal to make. My husband and I actually have enjoyed pierogi twice this week.
Awesome. Laura, what is the favorite filling in your household?
Well, we have two. Our very favorite is spinach, garlic, a little bit of Asaggio cheese, and sour cream. And then I also like to make one with potato, leek, carrot, and cabbage, and a little bit of cheese.
Wow. Laura, thanks for sharing that. Christoph, Laura is experimenting kind of the same way you are at your restaurant.
Sounds delicious. And it really warms my heart to hear people trying to apply different ingredients into pierogies. Owning Prince of Pierogi Restaurant made me realize how important this food is, how important the heritage is to American people. And it's really great to hear all different ideas because I learned from people too. So many recipes that people shared with me, I would say it's been at least 50 different pierogi recipes so far, just only inspired me to create different specials and try them out for myself.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura. And I want to turn to another dish that I got to say I didn't grow up with, the hunter's stew. I like stew. What goes into a Polish hunter's stew?
Mm-hmm. So Polish hunter stew, it's called bigos. It has its own name, bigos. It's a mix of fermented cabbage, sauerkraut, and fresh cabbage, tomatoes, mushrooms, onions, and a variety of meats. That's what makes it a hunter stew. So whether it's venison, ground beef, kielbasa is a must. You could put pork, and it's a tomato-based stew that you cook with beef broth with a variety of spices such as parsley, smoked paprika, salt, pepper, basil, rosemary, bay leaf. You slow cook the hunter stew for hours. It's served with warm bread. It makes a great meal. It's a hearty meal. It's very traditional to Polish cuisine. In any list of the top most popular Polish foods, you will frequently see the hunter stew being featured in top five among pierogies and gołąbki's.
Time for one more caller. Tom is with us calling from on the road. Tom, hi.
Hey, I grew up in a Polish family in Chicago. I played at the Shanties festivals in Krakow and Warsaw, and I live in Madison, which has the most incredible food, I think, in America. But why are there no Polish restaurants in Madison? We need you.
Tom, thanks for the call. Christoph, I don't know if we can lure you out of Door County at all, but you saw that's part of why you're opening your restaurant. You saw a very low Polish restaurant per capita ratio here in Wisconsin.
Exactly. That's what really motivated me to represent my culture, represent my home country, and, be in my favorite place in the world, which is Door County, Wisconsin. I would be easily persuaded to venture out to different cities in the U.S., and I'm not going to say I have some dreams for the future to expand the restaurant and carry on this brand to other cities. However, for now, I'm just focusing on my little restaurant in Ephraim in Door County since it's going to be my year four. So I'm still focusing on the reviews online, on creating the best possible experience for each guest, on mastering all of the ingredients that go into a perfect customer experience. And only when I'm super comfortable with letting my little restaurant be run by my staff, only then I will be courageous enough to try open another restaurant in another city in Wisconsin.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. Thanks for that call. And Christoph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Christoph Kroll, owner of Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. We talked to him today about Polish cooking for this week's edition of Food Friday. You can keep sharing your Polish food favorites and experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the race for space started as a contest for countries, but in the last 20 years, private businesses have taken center stage. Look behind the scenes of the companies racing for orbit and beyond with the author of the new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about mothers.
Many of us are grateful for everything our mothers taught us. For Jana Rose Schleiss, she's thankful that her mother taught her how to be beautiful.
I learned how to be a woman from my mom. What I mean is, I learned how to express my femininity from her. This isn't unique to me. For a lot of people, our mother is our first beauty standard. We grow up thinking she's the prettiest woman in the world. For girls, at some point in our lives, we gotta decide what kind of woman we wanna be and how we present that to the world. Through a million minuscule choices, we express ourselves and our femininity. The older I get, the more I realize I've been modeling myself off mom in subtle and not so subtle ways. My mother was a teacher. She also had 5 kids and a dairy farm to help run. When we were younger, she didn't have time for frivolous beauty trends or anything that wasn't practical. My 3 sisters and I, however, wanted everything new and impractical the early aughts could offer. Blue eyeshadow, the infamous Rachel haircut, and oh my gosh, flip-flops. When my mother goes out, her routine is this. Makeup, mascara, a bit of eyeliner, lipstick, hair. A few curls applied to her cropped locks, then brush back. Accessories. She keeps her most worn jewelry in a shot glass in the kitchen cupboard. I don't know how this became the norm. It drives my father, who bought much of it, crazy. She dumps the glass out, chooses a pair of small hooped earrings, and puts the many gold rings she wears on her hands. She's ready. I'm 30 now, and I've had plenty of time to experiment with my femininity. For style, there was the mismatched floral print phase, the crop tops and platforms phase, and this was all just during college. My hair journey has been similarly chaotic. For the few years I was a wannabe hippie, I didn't cut or even brush my hair. I could tell it drove my mother nuts, but she had a light, perhaps sometimes passive-aggressive touch. I'd receive gift cards for haircuts and the quick aside of, run a comb through your hair and then we'll go. But overall, she knew I needed to work through this stuff on my own. I've been dyeing my naturally brunette hair red for 10 years. This vibrant hair has become my brand, if you will. A friend recently asked why I chose this color. I told the story of how it initially happened. I got a horrid haircut before studying abroad. I bought a box of dye and tried to take control of the situation. To my 20-year-old self, this made sense. But looking back, it's obvious why red is the ideal beauty standard to me. For as long as I can remember, my mom's hair has been dyed shades of auburn. By the way she carries herself, my mother has taught me to never be ashamed of my body. She's always seemed so comfortable in hers. Something I'm very thankful for in a world that sends women messages like, you're too fat, you're too tall, you're too loud, you're too assertive, you're too independent, and the choices you've made are wrong. When I was younger, my mom let me be whatever I needed to be. All through puberty and the many confusing chapters after, I could always come to mom. She'd take me and my questions about my body and beauty seriously. I have nieces now, and I know they're watching, taking in the variety of women around them. They giggle at my armpit fuzz, want to touch my nose ring. They'll grow into their femininity one day too, play around with it, and try different things. I'm so grateful they have many strong and beautiful women in their lives to take cues from. When I go out, my routine is this: makeup, mascara, brows, lipstick, hair, a few curls, brushed back, accessories. From a jewelry box, I choose a variety of cheap gold rings and a pair of earrings. I know I'm ready. I know I'm beautiful because of Mom.
Jana Rose Schleiss brought us that story on her beautiful mother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Space used to be considered the fictional final frontier, science fiction explorers going where no one had gone before. Then real-life countries started to make space travel a reality. People in orbit, then on the moon, probes to our nearest planetary neighbors and beyond, powered by national space agencies and big-name contractors. But then things changed. Our next guest says there was a major turning point when space suddenly became a new open field for private industry and lots of companies who've gotten in on the act. That, he says, is the greatest technology story of our time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow the latest news on space, rockets, and what's going on in Earth's orbit? Have you been following the trials and tribulations of SpaceX, Blue Origin, or the smaller rocket and space commerce startups out there? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley Vance is a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek and the host of the Bloomberg show Hello World, which focuses on inventors and scientists. His books include Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the quest for a fantastic future. His newest book is called When the Heavens Went on Sale: The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think when people think of, you know, newer companies getting into the space business, they might think of SpaceX and Elon Musk. Your book highlights there is a lot going on beneath that surface. Can you talk about the variety of players in this rising industry?
Yeah, I mean, SpaceX definitely, I argue in the book, was this inciting incident for what has come since. I don't think most people are aware, which is why I wanted to write this thing, that there are dozens of rocket startups all around the world. There are hundreds of satellite startups all around the world. There are entire nations that are becoming spacefaring nations for the first time. And we're in a bit of a race right now among all these commercial companies to put up many thousands of times more satellites around the Earth than have ever existed before.
What led to the transition between, like I said, you know, a space program is your space agency and some really big name contractors in the aerospace industry, to the idea that lots more players can come in and, you know, maybe with some government support and contracts, of course, and try lots of smaller experimental things?
A lot of it was timing and then also a mentality shift. I think we reached a point where there had been huge advances in materials, huge, huge advances in electronics that helped bring the cost of these rockets down, the cost of satellites down, that made them better, and that also made it feasible for smaller teams to try and do these things as opposed to nation states. And then I think it was just this awakening. Space, it seems futuristic and advanced and all that, but it had been stuck for about 60 years. The underlying technology really had not changed much. And so you suddenly had a group of people who believed they could have a clean slate and do something new.
You share a lot of the personalities behind this as well as the technology. And one of the most interesting ones I thought was this chance meeting, an argument actually at a bar between a bunch of self-proclaimed space hippies and then a military, an Air Force general who had worked on the Strategic Defense Initiative for Star Wars and black operations and things like that. And this was a pivotal moment. Can you share a little of that story?
Yeah, this general's name is Pete Warden. He's one of my favorite people and characters in the book. He was an astrophysicist by training. He was in the Air Force, but through his decades in the military and the government, he'd always been this iconoclastic figure who really wanted to do space differently. And through a series of events, he ended up inheriting, becoming the director of NASA Ames, which is Silicon Valley's NASA center. And he took this as an opportunity to not just change NASA, but space overall. And there was this group of youngsters that he'd met at some of these space conferences. They were space hippies. They were idealistic. They also wanted to do different things in space. And so he flooded NASA Ames with all these 20-somethings. And, you know, NASA had this allergic reaction to this idea they could do things cheaper and better, but many of these people succeeded, and they've started a lot of these commercial space companies that we have today.
Now, we might see some of the higher profile, you know, rocket launches, like the most recent one from SpaceX, but it seems like a big part of the story is this explosion, I guess, not so dramatic as that one, but a huge rise in the number of satellites up in Earth's lower orbit. Can you talk about the scale of the growth in our satellites?
I don't think people are aware of this, but they should be, which is why I wrote the book. But from about 1960 to 2020, we had a sum total of 2,500 satellites in low Earth orbit. And just in the last 3 years, that number has gone up to 8,000. It's going to double next year. It's going to reach 100,000 satellites within the next decade and possibly keep growing from there. And I argue in the book, what we're doing is building what I describe as a computing shell around the Earth. This is the next stage of our technological advancement and infrastructure. And it just happens to be taking place over our heads, as opposed to doing things like laying fiber optic cables under the ground here on Earth.
We're talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What hopes or fears do you have about the commercialization of space? What role should governments, say the U.S. government or international organizations, have in regulating it? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the commercialization of space with Ashley Vance. His new book is When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. I've traveled 49 states and always looking for the darkest experiences, from the loneliest road in Nevada to the southern Alaska. And I found that the best dark sky viewing I've ever seen in my life is in the northern, far northern tip of the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, called Brockway Mountain. And that summer sky there is probably as close to it as any place could be. And it pains me, because one night I was up there and I saw what I would call a string of pearls. And I think it was a recent Elon Musk launch of satellites, and it was like six satellites all in a row. And it just pains me to be thinking that those dark skies are going to be completely gone. So if anybody from Wisconsin or the Midwest hears this and wants to see it before it does fade, Mount Brockway up in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, is probably the best dark sky that I've seen in any of the 49 states.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, not the only one concerned, Ashley, about the changing vision of our night sky because of artificial satellites. I know there's some scientific concern from astronomers as well. Are we going to see enough satellites up there that it's really going to spoil our view?
Yeah, those were almost certainly the SpaceX satellites he was talking about for their Starlink internet system. And this is why I wrote the book now. Nobody's paying attention to this stuff. I mean, my book is optimistic overall, because these things are going to do some very important functions for us. But to be honest, you can just expect more and more of that. This is going to be a regular occurrence. Astronomers are concerned. Other people are concerned. I was sort of shocked that astronomers voiced these concerns so late, because we were all knew what SpaceX was going to do. There is some inevitability to all this now.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And on a related note, Ashley, it's not just looking crowded from here on Earth. There are more and more satellites from governments and militaries and startups, so many that there's another startup that's kind of what, acting as an air traffic controller?
That's right. Yeah, there's a company called Leo Labs. And obviously, we've had government systems for tracking objects in space. This company has built a new type of antenna. They're building a network of antennas around the world. They can see pretty much every object in space down to a couple of centimeters, so even debris from things. But this is the stage we're at. It's great that this company exists. It's also a small 50-person startup that is now in charge of leading the way on managing all of this. And this is, again, the reality people need to be aware of.
Is there a thought that some more organized body is going to come in and start regulating this? I mean, I just try to picture okay, we've got all these airplanes in the sky, and then some guy started a business to help make sure they don't crash into each other. It doesn't sound like an ideal system to me.
It's in everyone's best interest, obviously, that this works, especially the satellite companies, because if you have a crash, you have every chance of creating this kind of cascading debris field. And the federal regulators are looking over this. I think they are having trouble keeping up with the pace that this industry is going. They're used to this 60, 70 year old pace that's flipped very quickly. And so I'm not, it's just not at all clear how this is going to play out. But again, for these companies, it's essential that they figure this out. And so they want all of this to work.
Talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, so much of your book is you on the ground, checking out these companies as they succeed or fail at their various experiments. Which companies struck you as ones that, even if they're not household names right now, maybe they should be?
Well, there's a company called Rocket Lab, which is based in New Zealand and was founded by this guy named Peter Beck. And it's an incredible story. He never even went to college. He worked as an apprentice at a dishwasher manufacturer and was building rockets in a shed behind his house. He was making his own propellants. He ended up creating a rocket and then another one, and now a very large company that's valued at several billion dollars and is the second coming of SpaceX. He did all this in New Zealand, which has no aerospace history. He's set pretty much every first you can have for the Southern Hemisphere in terms of aerospace. And just in it's a story that I think points to how far we have come from this being something pursued just by nation states, just by billionaires, that this driven individual and his team were able to pull this off.
Another individual key to another one of these companies you talk about in the book is a Ukrainian named Max Polyakov. I hope I'm saying his name right. Can you share about his story and the company he helped created and ultimately had to leave?
Max is maybe the tragedy in the book. He was an OBGYN by training. Shifted his career in Ukraine to become this multimillionaire software magnate. His parents both worked on the Soviet space program. And a company in Texas that was building a rocket went bankrupt called Firefly, and Max bought it. He put $250 million into this company. Max is an incredibly eccentric, driven, quite chaotic individual, and he ends up being thrown out of his company by the U.S. government. You could check out the book to sort of see how this interplays with the war in Ukraine. But yes, I mean, this is the drama that's taking place in this industry as politics and commerce and all of these new realities collide.
Speaking of realities, this may feel, a way away from us here in Wisconsin, startup companies around the world, stuff happening up in low Earth orbit. How are we going to be feeling the impact of this expansion in the satellites and the things they're doing in the next few years?
The most immediate things that these thousands of satellites are doing are the space internet that we talked about. And so people probably listening have a number of them probably have Starlink, where you get high-speed internet in a place you previously could not be reached by high-speed internet. That same story is true for 3.5 billion people around the world. And then there's a huge class of imaging satellites, which are, as opposed to images from space being rare and very expensive, we are now flooded with millions upon millions of images that capture everything happening, literally everything happening on Earth every day. A company called Planet Labs is the leader in this. And so we're getting this picture of the, I call it like the sum total of human activity on Earth. And in the Midwest in particular, farmers are using these satellites to check on the health of their crops. They can see how much chlorophyll is in the crops and the ideal time to harvest them and the health of their fields.
One thing that struck me just from you being on the ground at so many of these sites, and you write about this, we might picture, you know, oh, a rocket lab, a launch facility as this like amazing piece of set design from the most elaborate science fiction movie. And tell us about the reality. What do these places really look like?
Some of the startups are pretty fancy. Rocket Labs got some fancy things, but the actual launch sites themselves are crazy. they tend to be near the equator. The Earth actually spins faster at the equator. It gives these rockets some extra boost, and that they also tend to be by water, so they don't blow up and hurt things and people. And so I went to India, I went to French Guiana, I went to Svalbard, which is another extreme at sort of the farthest north on our planet. And this is where much of the space infrastructure is. It's quite dated. A lot of this was built in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it's remote and quite poor. It was just such the opposite of what I was expecting going into reporting on space.
In just our last half minute, this is a business that changes quickly. What is the next big space story you have your eye on?
Well, I really think it's just watching to see if the business case behind all of this stuff arrives. We've pumped $280 billion into this industry. There seems to be a lot of promise, but now is the real test to see just how far this goes and which ones of my characters survive into the next chapter.
Ashley, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ashley Vance, a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, host of the travel show Hello World. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.